Up to this point, I should think that if you were visiting here for the first time, you'd never want to go anywhere else. There is, as it turns out, a second part of the morning, and that keeps us able to have seating available for people. 2 weeks ago, we began a series of sermons about how to measure whether we are making any progress in the development of character. Is there some objective test, some visible harvest in our lives, so that we and those who know us can tell if we are advancing in what the Apostle Paul calls the life of the Spirit? In his letter to the Galatian church, he lists 9 personality traits which he calls the fruit of such a life, starting out with love, joy, peace. We've talked about the first two. This morning we try to define what he meant by eirene, peace. It transliterates, bringing letters across, into the English letters I-R-E-N-E, and became a popular name for thousands of women with no idea of how richly the word means in the Koine Greek of the New Testament. For the word peace in English, we have a wide range of meanings. Peace in our time, what price peace, which relate to war. Hold your peace means, more bluntly, keep your mouth shut. To make one's peace with another is to be reconciled. The peace Paul has in mind, eirene, is complex and harder to get a handle on. He admits, in fact, in another letter, that the peace of God is beyond our utmost understanding. As I have indicated by the title, it's internal, a state of mind. In Paul's own words, it guards our hearts and minds, not our homes and countries. It is independent of storms and battles going on outside ourselves. We may, at the same time, be in war and at peace. You may have to think about it later today, but I know it to be a possibility. In war and at peace, which explains the paradox in which Jesus says in one breath, I give you my peace, and in another breath says, I come not to bring peace, but a sword. It's easy to discover in his life the sword part. This man was so radically different that even the members of his own family fell out with him. The masses mostly missed what he tried to tell them. The ruling classes and religious leaders feared and distrusted him. His closest friends deserted him. And in the catastrophic end of his life, he felt that even God had abandoned him. Any peace of mind he managed must have been different from what we expect. So no wonder he said to his friends shortly before he died, the peace I give you is not what the world calls peace. One of the great understatements of all time. But No need to worry about the world's mistaken notion of peace, he tells them, because I have conquered the world. I want you to imagine some Roman soldier standing just close enough to hear this itinerant rabbi and his dirt-poor friends talk about conquering the world. At that moment, without question, Jesus of Nazareth was either insane or else he was the true prince of a totally different kind of kingdom, an issue the world has to decide again in every generation. One thing is clear. He was surrounded by conflict from the moment he entered public life until the day of his violent death. So whatever he meant by peace has little to do with either the safety of solitude or the avoidance of battles. It is found in the midst of the strain and stress of life, not in hiding from it. We can sympathize with people who grow so weary of conflict that they want to hide. The great Italian poet Dante, desperately craving to get away from controversy, knocked at the door one day of a Franciscan monastery and was asked by the friar, "What do you wish?" Dante spoke a single word, "Peace." Harassed medieval Christians often went to a monastery or a convent in search of tranquility. I mean no offense to those who lived decent and useful lives in such places, but I think Christ never once thought of our finding peace in that way. He imagined a refuge inside the mind. He expected our peace to be portable, not a withdrawal from life, but a daily confrontation with it. On the rear wall of a cathedral in Aberdeen, Scotland, the apostles are all pictured in vivid color with a note below each one about how that one died. Now, I think one would be foolish to believe all those notes as history, but they mean to make a point. They have the Apostle Peter dead on a cross, turned upside down, the old legend being that he did not feel worthy to die in the same way his master had died. They have James beheaded, his brother John boiled in oil, Andrew stoned and then crucified for good measure, Bartholomew tied up in a sack and thrown into the sea, Matthew burned at the stake, Thomas run through with a spear, Philip crucified, James stoned, Paul beheaded. Now surely somebody in that group died in bed. And I think we have a right to doubt a tradition so typical of early Christian hagiography. And that jawbreaker simply means the creation of saints. But it was meant as a sobering reminder to the people who came to that cathedral to worship that whatever the peace was Christ promised, it was not freedom from trouble. It could only point the peace he talked about to inner confidence and trust in the midst of trouble. I read the other day about 8 adults and 5 children who left Cuba one Saturday morning about 3:30 under cover of darkness in hopes of reaching the United States. They were jam-packed into a 16-foot blue and white fiberglass boat. And if you can imagine 13 people in a boat of that size, You can visualize the conditions. They were within sight of Florida when their motor died and left them largely helpless before high winds and huge waves that threatened to swamp the boat every minute. The children were in pain from sunburn. Everybody was seasick. People bailed water with their hats and paddled with their hands. It seemed hopeless to them. But with the help of a tiny compass, they finally washed up on the very beach near Hollywood, Florida, where I once swam and walked for several days. All of them blistered, dehydrated, hungry, but ecstatic to reach the kind of freedom most of us take for granted. When they were asked how they endured that ordeal, one young man said their hope and faith were so strong, they simply had no room in their hearts for thoughts of failure. That level of trust, that confidence in the worst of circumstances is hard to imagine. Faith, I suspect, is not always easily distinguished from madness, which is probably why the Apostle Paul felt it necessary to remark that the peace of God can at times surpass all comprehension. I once reviewed a couple of biographies of Robert Louis Stevenson and came to know the extraordinary difficulties under which he wrote. I found a story about a certain literary critic who read some of Stevenson's books and essays and then complained in his printed review that only a very sheltered writer, protected from the grim realities of life, could write with so much serenity and optimism. You let this extraordinarily and exasperatingly happy person have one touch of rheumatic fever, he wrote, and he will quickly change his tune. What the critic did not know was that Stevenson wrote out of greater suffering and infirmity than almost anyone who has ever tried that exhausting work, wandering the world in search of climates that would improve his health, frail, but filled with such indomitable peace of mind that those who read his books have no way of guessing how hard it was to write them. I should remind you now that pulpits are useless or dangerous or both if they are not honest. So I want to be honest and tell you freely that people have had inner peace without the help of the Christian faith. The point of this sermon is that the Christian faith takes such serenity and peace of mind as one of the hallmarks of those who profess it. In other words, we can test ourselves by the power of its presence. It seems obvious when you read about it in books and meet it in real life that what Paul calls the peace of God is essentially a deliverance from self. I want you to give those words full room in your thought for a moment. Deliverance from self. It may be the most challenging single phrase in all religious thought. Why are we so often not at peace? So often torn up and distracted and worn out by our own inner turmoil? Well, the answer, I think, in part at least, is that somebody has snubbed us, or at least we think so. Somebody is about to cheat us. Somebody won when we lost. Somebody else had more praise, got a quicker promotion. Self, self. Self, constantly puffed up with importance, so swollen an ego that we can hardly walk anywhere without banging it against something and bruising it, or having somebody else bump into it and bruise it. So the peace Paul expects as a fruit of Christian character comes from putting self in perspective. Do you know anything harder? One of the results of inordinate ego and vanity is that we have a hard time forgiving those who wound us, even when they ask. And holding a grudge is a strenuous business. It literally wears us out. We rehearse the offense constantly, reminding ourselves of what he did, she did, they did, a bitter and useless labor that destroys peace of mind. Jesus understood this so well that in a startling comment from his Sermon on the Mount, he said, even if you are at worship and you remember that your friend has something against you, you leave the church, temple, synagogue, to go and seek reconciliation and only then come back. I can only speak for myself, but estrangement from people I like makes me too miserable for any mental peace. There is another thing. The tranquility Paul describes also comes in considerable part when we are delivered from obsession, underline the word, with things. The prescription is not for a barren and deprived life. Things can be good. I like them. Nothing is wrong with their ministry to a pleasant life unless they become an obsession. And who makes that judgment? No one, with much effect, except ourselves. I would be a much unloved czar of education, I'm afraid, because my list of required readings would in the first place be long, and in the second place, among them would always be Thoreau's Walden Pond, that American classic of how not to be obsessed with gadgets and luxuries, how to live a simpler life than you thought you could. I am as selfish and greedy as most people, so I go back occasionally for a repeat dose of Thoreau's medicine. I need at times the odd advice given to a man visiting in the Blue Ridge Mountains, whose host gave him a kerosene lamp, showed him his bed in a lean-to part of the house, and said, now, if there is anything you want, let us know, and we'll come and show you how you can do without it. One of the few good things about moving from one house to another is that we discover how much clutter is in our lives that we don't need, but we've been unwilling to toss. Now, since this is a church, I should include in this sermon one of the Beatitudes: blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Not the peace hopers, mind you, nor the eulogizers of peace, like myself at this moment, but those who actively try to make and keep peace. Listen very carefully to what comes next, because this is so common a problem. Probably every one of us in this room has been guilty of this mistake, and every one of us in this room has been hurt by this mistake. So listen. St. Augustine, the Apostle Paul's equal, I think, in his influence on Christian thought, said of his mother, Monica, that, quote, "She showed herself such a peacemaker that hearing on both sides most bitter things, she would never disclose aught of the one unto the other, but what might tend to their reconcilement." Elegantly said, and passing a little too quickly perhaps when you hear it read aloud, but surely your experience is like mine in confirming Monica's great wisdom. On far too many occasions I have been told about somebody's critical remark when there was no need for me to know, and when the revelation only upset my peace of mind and made a trustful friendship with that person a little harder. When you think back over the times when somebody has unnecessarily relayed an unkind remark, you can feel the force of the Beatitude. Blessed are those who make and preserve peace. These sermons are meant to be a kind of midterm exam to see how well we are growing in the 9 fruits of the Spirit Paul named. So, hear about one of them. The one we're talking about this morning is a final piece of advice eloquently spoken by the great apostle. If you believe in goodness, and if you value the approval of God, fix your minds on whatever is true and honorable and just and pure and lovely and praiseworthy, and you will find that the God of peace will be with you. It's one fix you never have cause to regret.